My aunt's little ones are doing a 9-week course. And I mean, I know they're really Olic and stuff, but I just think it's kind of cruel. Because when she says sit, they sit. When she says come, they come. And now, she's teaching them tricks, like party tricks and stuff. I mean, it's exploitation. Come on, I mean, the poor dogs.
The combination meal, inspired by 7 colors, is something for everyone. Nando's, fire it up.
This is CliffCentral.com.
Vusi Tembakwayo has been on the show with me before. He was a real hit last time. People downloaded it in their droves, and I thought, well, any excuse to have him back. But he gave me the excuse before I had to look for one by writing a book called The Magna Carta of Exponentiality. And he's here this morning to talk to us about all kinds of things. Vusi, it's nice to see you again, man.
Thank you so much for having me.
You look younger and healthier and happier. What's been going on?
Gym.
Yes, good
little,
man.
A little less stress.
Yes.
By choosing to worry about a few worse things.
80-20 rule.
This is it.
Okay.
This is it.
And more money.
Just a tad. Just a tad. It can't hurt. Just a tad.
I love it. So are you one of those people who doesn't really have a nasty thing to say about 2017?
It had its fair share. Yeah. You could paraphrase them into two words, which is a silly character on Twitter, but I'd leave that there.
So listen, what on earth did you think when it came to writing a book? I mean, aren't you too busy to be writing a book?
Yeah, there was an excuse for a long time, right? And it actually wasn't an excuse. It was true. I think when you're building a business, you'll understand it. There's so much to worry about. There's the administration of the business. There's the strategy of the business. There's the sales. There's a whole host of things. The staff. I mean, just that alone, I think you could write a thesis on for, you know, for the next 1,000 years about how to manage people. And even then, you still wouldn't understand 10% of the subject matter. So it was, for a long time, it was a project that I'd wanted to do. But I also knew that when we did it, I had to do it correctly. So I was patient with myself. And then when the time came, I just took the time out and I dedicated myself to doing it.
Also, a book is such a permanent thing. It's going to be there one day. Your kids will read about it, your grandkids, your great-grandkids. It's something that you leave permanently in the record, you know. Not like a radio interview that goes away like this or a meeting that you have where there are only a couple of people present.
100%.
So this is different. And you've done a lot of public speaking, but usually people forget 70% or more of that when they walk out of the room.
In fact, it's interesting you say that. One of my real fears before I started the book project, as a little boy, my father used to say to me, you've got to be careful what you write because it'll outlive you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I see people do it now, which I think is interesting. People write because they're in the moment and they write about the moment.
Right.
And they forget the time as a way of dating moments. So you could write something that really looks great now. And then in 20 years, people go, what were you thinking?
Yeah, you're like a Neanderthal then. 100%. People are like, what kind of nonsense is this? Almost like he's defending the indefensible.
Exactly.
Or times have moved on and he's no longer.
They did it to Gary Player, because Gary Player wrote an interesting article in the late 70s, early 80s, where he was talking about golf and why there were no black players in golf. And in the article, he actually defended why there were no black players in golf. He didn't anticipate that we would be where we are today and we would have had a Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Gary Player ended up getting attacked because people said, but how could you say this? What were you thinking, right? So, yeah, it can happen.
Well, I'm not worried about your book because I think there's some stuff in there that's going to be true for as long as humans walk the earth and for as long as people are willing to trade in their supply and demand and these basic, you know, effects, cause and effects in society. But let me just give you a proper introduction. It's the least you deserve. You've carved a massive...
You're not going to do this, are you?
No, I'm going to. In front of you. I want to see how you respond. Carved a massive reputation as a prominent entrepreneur, investor, global business speaker, and now author. Has spent the last 15 years cultivating his own exponential growth, sharing his unique insight to over 350,000 people in 17 countries across the world. And your voice has traversed the world of public speaking, entering you into the orbit of entrepreneurship, business leadership, government, and academic luminaries, and you don't mind getting into fights with people occasionally when it's called for as well. So the reason I decided to throw in the whole intro, and that's only part of your whole story. I mean, we can talk in a little while about my growth fund and all that stuff. But it's because for a lot of people, it's very difficult to believe that you've done all the things that you've done in the time that you've done it.
Sure.
And for other people, they can't believe how long it's taken you because they have unrealistic expectations of what the world can give them and what they can do for the world.
Sure.
In the short term. So time is a very useful weapon when it's used properly, when you have patience, something I'm trying to learn to do. But it can be very, very hard to come to terms with.
Yeah.
How are you feeling at this stage of your life? I mean, are you feeling like an accomplished man who's looking for new, exciting frontiers? Or are you someone who's still battling some old demons? Are you someone who is feeling half satisfied, maybe even a little complacent? What's the overriding feeling as we start the new year?
Achieved, but restless. Right. So it's the achieved bit is that there are parts of things that I wanted to do. When I look at the list and I go, okay, so that's done. Okay, that's definitely done. And that's great. It's great to tick boxes. It really is fantastic to develop a list and watch that list change over time, but also watch yourself change over that space of time. And some things that were on the list just don't matter anymore. So you go, well, what was this ever on the list for?
What was important to you 5 years ago that's gone off the list?
Oh, it's going to sound so ostentatious.
Go for it.
So ostentatious. I wanted a jet. A G7. I really did. So I told you it's going to sound ostentatious.
Yeah, that's all right. So where did it fall off the list?
It did when I realized that all possessions are expression. Things we possess express something about us. The t-shirts we wear, the watches we wear, the cars we drive, the homes we live in. They're all forms of expression. Mm-hmm. People tend not to think about possessions as forms of expression, but this is why we have fashion and difference and trends, because we are trying to self-express through possession. And when you understand that, you then go, so if I were to buy this, what am I trying to say? And why can't I just say it? Why do I need to incur 250, I don't know, million rand expense to say something? Why can't I just say it? And what is the impact of me having said it? Does it leave the world a better place?
So what are you saying when you want a jet?
You're saying that a young boy from a township raised by a single mother can do it.
It's just like a really, really rich Scotan.
Precisely. This is it. You got it. It's the Ultramel syndrome.
Yeah, because the great thing about that analogy, it's crude as it is that it doesn't matter how much money you have, you can still be mentally a Scotan, right? You can. And similarly, you can also be like one of those people. I'm not there yet, but there are those very evolved people. I surmise you're closer to it than I am because you've just explained the problem. Those people who actually have no interest in the material, they create wealth and success, but that's almost a byproduct of them wanting to connect people and do good things and change the world in positive ways. Those people are in a different realm almost.
Yeah. So that for me is the space I gotta tell you, it's frightening and it's exciting. Because what you're doing almost is you're questioning the very core of your what has been your relationship with the world. Your relationship with the world is this fire that fuels you, right? It's this burning ambition. It's the reason that kid got in a taxi this morning, headed to Joburg, for whatever, from wherever. There is something there. There is a place to which you are going that symbolizes something better than where you come from. So there is a fire, an ambition, a passion, a hope, a dream, something, right? When what fuels that changes, the very fuel of your essence changes. The very reason you exist changes. What you bring to the world shifts. You go, yeah, so why do I need 200,000 followers on Twitter? Like, what's that going to say about me? And what am I trying to say? And to whom am I trying to say it, right? Mm. And it's such a fascinating space to get into, because as you traverse it, as you get into it, the hardest thing to realize is that there are no answers to the questions. The only thing that remains is the questions. And yet, the questions are more important than the answers.
Yeah, you sound like a philosopher.
Well, perhaps I've been reading too much Nietzsche,
maybe you've been putting. What sort of philosophy? What do you read? Not just philosophy, but what do you read? I assume you're reading a lot, and you're one of those people who has tons of books that sit unread, waiting to be read.
Yes.
What are you reading at the moment? I mean, what's keeping you up at night?
Oh wow. I've just finished How the
Mighty. Please don't say Thomas Piketty.
No.
Horrified.
Why, you don't like Thomas?
No, I just think it's obvious fraud and nonsense. So back to you. I mean, that's just a naivety about human nature.
Right.
That's
why
what it is.
Why is that a naivety about human nature?
Because there are people like him who just never take into consideration that there are individuals with aspirations and that some of those aspirations might be bad, that they're not always good. This is my problem with Marxists, is a lot of them are, they mean well. They think that that's a more compassionate line to take, and that if we all work together collectively, we could bring about a better world, which is a good thing, and maybe it's true, but they don't take into consideration that sometimes individuals rebel against the majority, and sometimes individuals are greedy, and sometimes individuals pursue their own course of action to the detriment of society.
Fascinating.
They just pretend it doesn't happen. And then, of course, the criticism that they level at the rest of us, who are much more moderate about our point of view, is, well, capitalism is evil.
Yes.
So there isn't any nuance
yes,
to it.
Yes, I was about to say this.
It's like they live in utopia
or disaster.
They don't seem to think that there's a middle road of mental stability.
Which is coincidentally where I would imagine most people live, actually.
Yeah, I think most people are not massively ideological. Most people are trying to either eke out an existence if they're at the low end of the income scale, and sometimes they find ways to be happy with family and love and friendship and meaning and purpose, and perhaps they're doing something that starts small and it grows. And maybe there are people who are doing amazing things at the other end that are world-changing, that are, you know, that turn economies on their heads. But I think most of us in the middle are just trying to be happy. We're trying to find a balance and equilibrium between work and play, between family and friends, and all of these things. And it's not an ideological struggle for most people.
Wow.
Don't you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're 100% right. I think most people are just in the business of getting on with it. But I also think that life is a way of beating ideology out of you, right? So if you are ideologically inclined, having lived, life will just beat it out of you. It'll show you that there is nuance.
Don't they always say that a child, or rather a young adult, is more likely than not to be a liberal because they're all heart?
Yes.
And that later on they'll end up a conservative because they're all head. You know? I mean, it's a cynical way of looking at things, but I do think it appeals to me in some way because I've seen it happen to people.
Yeah.
And you look at these kind of wise elders and you go, I understand why you want to keep things the way that they are because this is the world you understand.
Yeah.
You look at hot-headed young people and you think, I know why you want to change everything because this is not for you.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you.
There is a beautiful Malawian expression. It says, what an old man can see seated down under a tree, a young man having climbed two heights of mountains still wouldn't see.
I love that.
It's beautiful, right?
I've got to bring up something that it's very pertinent and topical right now. The matric results.
Yeah.
You've been outspoken about this almost singularly. I don't know that anyone else has made a massive public declaration about this, and I admire you for it. You said you think that it's bad to publish these results.
Yeah. Yeah.
That these are a private matter and that could be the cause of so much anxiety and stress and even suicidal thought among so many young people.
Right.
Your matric results shouldn't be something to boast about if you've done well, and they shouldn't be something to hate yourself about if you've done badly.
Yeah. Because we're breeding the same culture of the private jet thinking. We're saying, for me to find expression and achievement, it must be celebrated by others. And for that to be so, it must be in the knowledge of others. It's not true. Nor is it correct for us to do so. And we're setting a bad example for kids. And we're setting a bad example for young people. When we say to them, the only way we will validate your achievements as a young person is when we are, one, in the knowledge of them, and two, when you tell us and you boast about it. So there is, although subtle, a critical difference between celebrating success and boasting about success. Right. And if you ever want to know what the difference is, you must ask yourself, to whom is it going to cause offense when I do this thing? Right. So for me, if there is but even one young person who loses sleep over the idea that my results are being published tomorrow and my friends are going to know about it, then we know we're doing the wrong thing as a nation. I've heard people too say, yeah, but this is intended to motivate them. Look, if you want to motivate people by putting the knowledge of their performance in the realm of others, then why don't we all publish our salary slips and bank statements and tax refunds, recons,
and our private lives, who we're having sex with and when and how often.
This is it. And whether and how well they rate you. Yeah. Because you're saying...
Let your partner put out those results.
Because it's about motivation, yeah, right?
So it's rubbish.
I'm not sure where it comes from. So I've not done the study of where did we start, why and when did we start doing this, and for what reason.
But wasn't it just because in the beginning the newspapers were the best way to get the information out? Because otherwise the kids would have to go to the school, and sometimes the school had problems and they didn't get the results on time. So it was a case of the technology, the means of getting the information. Was just retained, and it became a public thing. I think it's horrible. I do think it's horrible.
What I've heard, some of the responses I got, one of them made me really sad. Somebody said, you know, these kids have got to toughen up. When we grew up, this thing was being done, and we got over it. And I kind of replied, and I said to the person, if we lived in a world where we did things because we'd always done them, could you imagine what world we'd be in? Could you imagine how many things we now know are dated and wrong? That were fine. There was a time sexism was fine.
We would have stuck to the horses and the oxen rather than developed cars.
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, we'd still be thinking some human beings on the basis of their color should be treated as sub-citizens. So we know that all ideas and all systems of thinking are generated for a period of time. When times move, we need to ask ourselves, but why are we continuing to do this? Mm. In a Twitter culture, with the venom and the vitriol that you find on social media, I'm not sure to whom it is of service for us to say so-and-so got this and so got that. Because what you're saying when you say Gareth got X is Vusi didn't. And what are you saying to Vusi about his prospects in the world? And it's just a final point on this. Matric is a year. It's not a lifetime. No. It's a year. I can't tell you how many people I know who did exceptionally well in matric, who've lived mediocre lives at best. And then I know people with whom I went to school who were okay and average at school who have done phenomenally well. Mm. So this thing is not a trajectory for where you end up in life.
But also this humble brag stuff that happens because of social media where people say, hashtag blessed, you know. And they want you to know that they've got the Ferrari. And then they go, hashtag blessed, as if it's just sheer luck that happened to them. But actually what they're saying is, I'm better than you.
Yeah.
And somehow in this country, we've got to find some happy medium between celebrating, in inverted commas, success and again, I'm going to say black excellence because it comes up so often in social media.
Right.
On the one hand, and on the other hand, denigrating people who haven't done well because by comparison with us, they make us feel better. That's like Schadenfreude at its worst. Huh?
Yeah.
Can I ask you one or two philosophical...
What is Schadenfreude?
Schadenfreude is the idea that you take pleasure in someone else's misfortune because it makes you feel not as unfortunate as them.
Right.
It's a German... I think it could even have something to do with Nietzsche, who first coined it, but it's basically this idea that you secretly take pleasure in other people's misery.
I see.
And you see that people, we don't have a word in English for it, I don't think. There might be words in other language, but I think the Germans coined that one for themselves a long time ago. Schadenfreude, yeah, it sounds awful, like a lot of German words. So, Vusi, I wanted to ask you philosophically, since we're onto this, how do you reconcile the idea which is so entrenched in South Africa of belonging, whether it's to a tribe, whether it's to a language group, whether it's to a race, whether it's to a country, with your very strong feeling of individuality? Where do you sit on that? Because I often get into debates with people, either people who, you know, they will proffer that Ubuntu is such a terrific system, but in many respects, Ubuntu does not take the individual's talents and characteristics into its process. And then on the other hand, you've got people who are completely anti any kind of communal activity, and they end up seeming like cynical, lonely, selfish people. Mm. How do you find that space?
I suppose I've never seen them as a continuum. I don't think that they're mutually exclusive, so that you're either on one end of the scale or the other. My relationship with those is that the one affirms an identity that has brought me to be, The other is about my relationship with the world. So I don't see them as part of the same conversation piece. So if I think about the tribe I come from, the family I come from, the rituals we have, and how we are raised, that for me is a function of identity, which is about this construct of I and how I identify with me. I don't see that as mutually exclusive with how I relate with the world, which is a function of my individuality. Suffice it to say that where I have, and it's happened before, where there has been a conflict between the two, I always deviate towards the individual sense.
You get a lot of criticism for that from a number of people. I mean, you've recently been in arguments with Sizwe Dlomo and Mbuyiseni Ndlozi because I think it suits some people's argument to pull you out of your identity and to say that somehow you've strayed and you're the problem.
Maybe
it's because they can't do that. Maybe because they feel if they leave the
clan,
security of that, of being part of a movement, a mass of people, that maybe they'll be like the emperor without any clothes on the outside.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you figure it out?
Yeah, so, wow. That's a really great question. You've got to write a book. The questions that should be asked. I'm serious.
Come on.
I remember this too from our last conversation. You're really talented in teasing out questions. This is
don't distract. It's not about me.
So, for the longest, for almost my entire life, I have battled with people trying to affirm for me an identity. So it's not new to me, this thing. Whether it was in high school when we were still called coconuts. And, you know, I was in high school. I got to tell you, when I was in high school, I was doing public speaking drama. I played the violin. I had my national colors in karate. I was fairly academic. So
coconut, you're an overachiever.
Yeah. So, but you got to remember, and I'm going to say something which might be controversial. In my day in high school, being black in a white school and overachieving was being white.
Yeah.
So black people and black kids chastised you for achieving in a white school.
But
and
you also didn't belong with the white people.
And you didn't belong with the white kids.
Because the white people thought, this guy thinks he's one of us, but we think we're superior to him.
Yeah, so you're not vusi, you're vusi.
And it bothers them that they weren't superior to you because you were outperforming them.
This is it. So look, I've spent my life in this gray area.
This is not what I wanted to do with this interview, by the way. I do want to talk about the book. We'll get to it. But I do think this is fascinating to me because it takes an enormous... What interests me about you, among all the other things, is that there's a courage of your own convictions, trusting your own gut, a feeling of, I don't need... all those plan Bs that so many other people have. And the belonging that is so important to other people when it comes to how they describe themselves. Because you are Vusi Tembekwayo. Before you're anything else.
My mother used to say to me, in fact say to us, when you are in the space of your truth, you will be many things, but you will never be wrong or a liar. You will never be wrong to the world because what you present is honest. And you'll never be a liar to yourself because you're honest to who you are. You'll be many things. You may be poor. You may be hated. But those two things you will never be. And those two things are the very essence of where we find peace. That's how you sleep at night. You sleep at night when you can connect your actions with how you see yourself. When there is a consistency in the values you espouse and how you behave. Most people lose sleep at night. And most people turn to other things and substance abuse precisely because they have disconnected the values either they were raised with or that they deeply hold with how they behave. So even though I go to church on a Sunday and even though I was raised in a deeply religious way and I do believe in a world that is based on merit and I do believe in a world that is clean and clear, I'm going to do corrupt things because I've got to make money and I've got to be seen to live the life. And if this is how people do business, then this is how I'm going to do business, even though it is a fundamental disconnect from how I see myself. And it's not me. I don't do it. And as a result, over years, I've lost business. But what's been fascinating is the over time, and time is an amazing corrective measure. It just has a way of correcting distortions in the system. Over time, that truth connects you with people who live in that space too. And typically those are people who are incredibly influential, very wealthy, and who can make a lot of things happen for you. So as a result, I mean, it just opens up a completely new world.
What you're saying is ringing so true for me. If you were Marcus Uyste a year ago, there are probably not a lot of people in the world who wouldn't have envied his circumstances.
Sure. Sure.
Here he was,
sure,
riding high,
yeah,
massively successful, yeah, JSE listed company,
yeah,
you know, part of everybody, every asset manager's portfolio. And then you look at him now, trying to flog off every racehorse he's got left,
yeah,
trying to stay out of jail. And you think, I wouldn't want his life for all the money he had before.
Sure. Sure.
I would rather be poor. I'd rather run a little business, spaza shop or something, wouldn't you? Than be in his situation now? Hell yes.
I think you're 1,000% right.
So I think people get confused when they see someone like you and they see the success that you've had and it disagrees with how they think the world really works.
Yeah.
So have you had people come to you, especially since you've published this book? And I mean, you've become, certainly in the last couple of years, a very well-known South African. So people can now track your kind of progress and success.
Humbled, thank you.
And I'm sure that there are people who knew you before that didn't like you or didn't want to like you.
Yes.
That have had to come round because they've realized that that pursuance of what you believed was honest.
Yes.
Has borne you fruit.
Yes.
Have you ever had anyone who's been brave enough or full enough of their own character and their own truth to come to you and say, hey, I'm sorry, I read you wrong, and I was wrong about you?
It has happened, but suffice it to say, it didn't matter.
No, I know it doesn't matter to you, but did it surprise you that those people managed to find that?
No. No, I mean, I when I say it didn't matter, I'm not saying that it was not without consequence, but that it was not in the motivation of the action. So. And this is important, right? Because when you move into no man's land of individuality, which is what individuality is, it's no man's land. And the reason we as human beings create collective systems of existence, I call them tribes, nations, the idea of the nation state, the empire, all of these are created so that we pull together a set of norms, and along with these norms we have rules that govern how we behave in a system.
And isn't it also because that's how we survive?
Well, this is
we
it.
Would never have made it off the plains as these, you know, primitive Homo sapiens if we hadn't stuck together in the beginning. Now, obviously, the world is slightly different.
Right.
The more individuality you express now, the likelier your chances of success. But in those days, that would have got you killed.
100%. 100%, right? So, because the world is a very different place.
So, like those people you were complaining about earlier, and I agree with you, those ones who just won't change, they think the old ways will always be the best ways.
Yeah.
They can't help it. That's in their evolutionary psychology.
Yeah.
It's hard to break out of that because it's scary. It's no man's land.
I mean, even social media is now, even on social media, people group. You know, so there's Black Twitter, which does what it does, and boy,
we've both been Black antagonized
Twitter
by them.
It's so good at what it does. It's a pity they don't get paid for it, because if they did,
I can't help thinking that's an insult.
If they did, God knows they would be living substantially different lifestyles, right? So there is that, and then there are the people who sort of find homes in political systems and political parties. Any system is going to have flaws. So the idea that I'm going to holistically buy into something is rubbish.
Because
when it has flaws, I reserve my right to go, this is wrong. And I'm not going to subscribe to it. And this is, you're going to see it, by the way, in the next few months with the once were, now no longer Jay-Z Brigade.
Yeah.
Who'll say, we all can't believe this
changed.
Guy.
Yeah.
You know, how did we have this guy? Yeah, but you defended him.
Oh, to the hilt.
And you went and said also, and that for me is what I find, that for me is what would cause me to lose sleep.
Advise me, because my instinct is to wholeheartedly agree with you and to jump in and to tell everybody, oh my God, you know, I had this conversation with Vusi Temagwayo this morning that was affirmative in so many of the things that I thought were true that are true for him as well, that we've both objectively reasoned may be
right.
The way the world operates, right. At least in certain areas. We don't know everything, but this is good. My fear in doing so is that I create trouble for you. Because it's bad enough that you have to put out fires where people think that you are not towing the line. Mm. But it's even worse when you have white allies who mean well, but they add to the trouble for you because they encourage race baiting on the other side to say, ah, but look, you see, you are just a coconut. You are just a,
yeah.
You know, you've learned from the white man how to excuse this deplorable behavior on their part. Yeah, and clearly you're a self-loathing black man and all that nasty shit that gets said.
Yeah.
Should white people who agree with you shut up? Is what I'm saying.
No. Because there is a certain courage that comes with truth. But even more than that, there is a deeper courage that comes in truth that is not convenient. So that you and I are going to be inconvenient in expressing that we found a singular truth.
Yeah.
It's just tough. Remember, time.
Yeah.
Over time will correct. Over time, someone smart enough will go, you know, a couple of years ago, these guys were onto this. They were so right. They were just ahead of their time, but they were so right when they said this. Because look at how far we've come, and we now know that this kind of us and them thinking just doesn't work. So I lose no sleep over it. Maybe let me say it differently, if I may, Gareth. Mm. If you're not in pursuit of acceptance and praise, it is of no consequence when you don't get it.
Right.
Because it wasn't what I was going for anyway. I wasn't going for this. If I was going for it, then I would have to force myself to say all sorts of things that are neither true nor are they ever going to be, because in the eyes of the public, those things would seem correct and then therefore would gain me acceptance. Yeah. This is why you're finding people who, it happens to me so many times, I've never understood it. You've actually just helped me understand it. This is why you find people who on social media will say all sorts of things about you. And then they bump in and they ask for a selfie. And hold on, what's wrong with this picture? Like, you're the same guy who, why are you... Ah, I get it. Because you're playing to the gallery then. You've got 12,000 people to whom you're looking for acceptance, and how you gain that is by attacking me. Ah. But in this space, with just you and me, okay, I understand it.
I'm guessing that there's also with those people some element of they need therapy. They maybe didn't get enough love from their parents. No, I'm really not being horrible. I'm trying to be as objective as possible. This is not an emotive conversation for me, because I think if these people didn't get enough hugs from their dad, maybe they didn't have a dad, maybe their mom was working hard and they didn't get enough love. And you need that when you're a child.
Sure.
It sounds to me, when you mentioned your mother earlier, there was that tone people who have enormous respect and gratitude for their foundation.
Yeah, yeah.
Give when they talk about their parents. Some people don't have that for whatever reason. It's not their fault. It is not your fault if this is you. I'm not knocking you. I'm not trying to make you seem in some way beneath us or inferior to us, those of us who have been fortunate enough to have parents that loved us every step of the way and supported us, helped us grow our own confidence. But if you spent the time, instead of being vitriolic and mean on social media, seeking therapy, and socializing yourself a little better, you might be able to break out of this ugly cycle that you're in.
Mm.
How did you, looking back now, understand the way you were raised to have been an advantage?
So I think even in the way you led to the question, there is a part of the answer there. But in part, I had two phenomenal parents. So my father was the sensei of the dojo. And when I was a little boy, my father introduced me to martial arts. We did Kyokushin as a discipline, which is full contact. And being the sensei's father, being the sensei's son, came with a whole host of expectations. The least of which is, had to be early to the dojo, had to be the last person to leave, had to help with the pack up, and you never lost a fight in a tournament. So I never lost a fight in a tournament.
And your dad wouldn't hold back on you.
Well, this is it. This is exactly right. Because I got the hardest end of it. But that wasn't... And then when we were at home, He was the softest, most gentle, caring man. Just most, was a, he's a huge, like a...
You never doubted he loved you.
Yeah, yeah. And so for me, what was interesting was I found in the heat of his intensity, his expression of love.
And your mother?
Mom was very soft with us, very kind. But if you crossed her, whoo... Still, to this day, mom is incredibly soft, caring, kind, loves her kids. Don't cross her. Because if you do, hell hath no fury. She will go to the ends of the earth and back to help you understand the pain you've caused and then to ensure that you reconcile with that pain. Mom was very good. Dad would punish us. Mom wouldn't. Mom would put us in a space where we punished ourselves. She helped you understand what you'd done.
Wow.
And how it made her feel.
That's manipulative.
Oh, man.
But brilliant.
Oh, man. Let me tell you. Because, so, and what it did is, as one grows, you grow up with a very strong sense of self-correction. So before I do wrong to Gareth, I go, hold on, hold on. Yeah. How is this going to make him feel and then therefore make me feel? So there was always a strong self-corrective measure there. So there's the discipline of the martial arts.
That's a massive amount of self-actualization at a young age.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course, you don't know it at the time, but your relationship with the world kind of...
So were you very precocious as a kid?
What's that mean?
No, I mean like... it's pejorative, but I don't mean it that way. What I mean is that you were advanced ahead of your age. There was a maturity, perhaps even... precociousness is the kid who answers the question before they're even asked. Precociousness is the kid who offers to do something before any adult has thought they were capable of doing it.
Right.
And then they're kind of impressed by the cheekiness, but at the same time sort of offended that the child might have this much confidence.
It didn't until Dad died.
Okay.
So Dad dies. I'm 13 years old. My father gets gunned down. And then... that kind of happened because when Dad was killed, oh man, Jesus, just took me to a dark place.
Sorry, I didn't mean that.
When Dad was killed, he was always the man of the home, and in our culture, father not around, oldest son becomes man of the home, and my mom sat me down and just had the conversation, and she said, "You're now going to have to step up." And I was 13. I didn't know what step up meant, you know, but it meant, as was the case, for instance, when my mom renovated our home, the contractors who came to do the renovation dealt in the main with me. They dealt with mom, but it was me they were dealing with. And I said, no, that's wrong. And the quality of that's wrong. So I had to learn to relate with much older people, be respectful, but at the same time, be demanding of what it is that one expects from a quality of work perspective. So it advanced my maturity, because it forced me to just be a bit more responsible. There wasn't much to go around after Dad died. So failing at school, for instance,
wasn't
an option.
And how many brothers and sisters?
So there was five of us. The two oldest had already kind of left school.
Right.
And I have an older sister and a younger brother. Right. So that was the sort of the makeup of the home. Huh. But I'll never forget the school I was at. My mom couldn't afford school fees. And she worked out a deal with the principal, Brian Lotter, at Benoni High. And the deal was, for every subject I got an A, I didn't have to pay. So going to school and being an achiever, it wasn't because I was particularly bright. There was an incentive. It was go to school, be an achiever.
You had to.
Kind of was a rebate system. And it meant there was money to go into other things. So we could get groceries, or we could get new school shoes, or all that kind of thing. So you are, again, when people come into the judgment of who you are, because when people, I always say this, anytime you judge something, remember that you see it at a point in time. You're just seeing it right now. This bottle of water is a bottle of water fully packaged. If I'm going to make a statement about it, the statement is not about the process that it brought it to what it is. It's about what it is. So when people make a judgment, it's always a point in time. And it lacks context, because if you understood the journey that has brought the individual to be, you might be a bit more compassionate and go, oh, I understand now why this person has a specific perspective or why they look at the world this way.
Do you think hardship and difficulty and a lack of resources and discrimination and all the problems that we have in society that make us unequal as people, do you think those things are a source of power and a source of strength and a source of character building, or do you think that they are obstacles that make it very hard for people and that create reasons to fail?
I have not yet found an example of somebody that built strong character, resilience, self-belief, not having faced those odds. And it is coward to face the odds and bemoan them. Because I don't believe my relationship with the universe is I don't believe it would bring into my life world anything I couldn't handle. It brings it into my life world, one, not only to teach me that I can handle it, and but two, most important, how to handle it. Because where I am going, I'm going to require it as emotional capital. So let's throw back 20 minutes ago. If I was not in a school where I was achieving at the rate at which I was achieving, and there were black kids sitting on the grandstands who were calling me a coconut and umlungu and all these things, I wouldn't today be able to withstand the pressure of a black Twitter. But I can, because even though the one is to the exponent of the other, they in effect one and the same thing. There are people sitting on the grandstands watching the parade go by and commenting about the parade, not understanding what has brought the parade to be. So it's fine.
Do you find that white people with superiority complexes
they fascinate me, by the way.
Take you more seriously in the light of material success than they would have if you had not had this success? Like, would they have treated you like they treat so many other black people?
Yes, yes.
If you hadn't had the success that you had? Which proves, of course, that they have a superiority complex and that essentially they're racist. They're discriminating.
Not only would they not, but they do.
Yeah.
Of course they do. Their relationship with you is, remember, their relationship with one is, what have you achieved in my world that affirms that you are worthy of my acknowledgement? And the things that I value as important to me, if you achieve them, then I know you and I can have a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, that's so complicated because you never know how deep that respect or meeting of minds goes.
Yeah.
Like, you have to question, because it's a shallow reason to condescend to someone, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what it is, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
It means you don't really know who you're. I mean, I don't doubt that you have real friends, black and white and all kinds, successful and unsuccessful, and people who. But I don't doubt you also have some numbers in your phone that would send shivers down my spine. Like, you could probably get hold of a couple of $1 billion if you needed it in a pinch. And that's more than friendship. That's trust. That's like, because friends, you don't lend hundreds of millions to.
But not if you want.
How do you know you crushed that threshold with every where you have a level with a certain individual of that mutual respect, where it's genuine?
It's
peer to peer.
Great question. The answer to which is, you don't know how you know, but you know. There is a point in the relationship where you know we are now firmly at a realm where we're relating differently. And there are a handful of people I have who are exactly as you've described it. Incredibly influential. Most of them don't live here. But South Africans, incredibly influential, global success, very, very wealthy. And just drop a phone call and they'll pick it up and we'll have a conversation. Right? And it might happen once every 3 months, might happen once every 6 months, once a year. But the respect is there, and it's genuine. So this is the danger of, you know, the only black at the table, right? It's I won't mention his name, but there's a fascinating fellow who lives in Franschhoek, and he's a black guy. He's done very well in business, and his currency in the Franschhoek community is he's a black guy who's done well in business. it's every time I'm down there, he fascinates me. He really does, because even his relationship with the sort of Grand Afrikaner community of the Stellenbosch Franschhoek area is, you know, look, guys, you know, I came out of that, got into your world, and I conquered. Therefore, I am worthy. And it is what it is.
I do love the stories that break the stereotypes, though. I'm sure you do too. Because they remind me a lot of the time, because we tend to fall into our normal patterns.
Yeah.
Whatever those patterns are, it might be that we're antisocial or we're skeptical about people's intentions or whatever. Yeah. I mean, you don't trust anybody. I'm sure you don't either. But when you hear these stories about how people kind of band together during a crisis, you hear about, you know, a businessman who really needed a leg up at a certain time and got it out of nowhere from some mystery help. Those things also count for a lot of people's success.
Sure.
And in your case, I'm sure that there are many people you've helped along the way that you don't talk about, that you don't want publicity for.
Yeah, yeah.
What motivates you to help?
I'd say three things. The first is that I've got to get a sense that the person has really extended themselves beyond their own ability. So typically people, what I'm seeing today, which makes me a bit sad, is people ask for help before they've really exhausted themselves. Just exhaust yourself. Like, do it.
Yeah. And you see a lot of this on Twitter. Someone wants a job or someone wants someone to pay for their education for them.
Yeah. And it's, but what have you done? I mean, it's, you know, it's show me how far you've gone and that you can go no farther. Because then I know that there is real deep intention in and an honest and earnest intention in what you want to do, certainly intent. That's the first. The second is that you've got to be genuine. And in the world today, that's hard because it is, remember the conversation we had earlier, it's so cool to belong and to be what the clan says you should be, that to really just be yourself and be honest and be genuine. I said it to, I had four entrepreneurs that came to see me last year, end of last year, I'll never forget. Four of them run an IT company that were looking for funding. And I said, so tell me what you guys do. And very nice fancy suits, got to tell you. Nice fancy suits, fancy watches. Watches and suits fancier than mine, and they're asking me for funding. I thought, this is fascinating. I said, what do you guys do? And, you know, the one sitting there goes, he says, well, I'm the chairman, he's the CEO, he's the CFO, he's the COO. I said, how big is your company? I said, no, it's just four of us. So I said, wait, if you guys are the chiefs, where are the Indians? Where does the rubber hit the road? And there is a place you go where you think that stuff's important. And the point I was trying to make to them is just be genuine. Just go, well, you know, I collect the money. He does the selling. He finds the clients. He does the work. That's kind of how it works, guys. It's not, you know, it's what do you need to clothe it in this thing? And what are you trying to prove? And so just be genuine. Just be who you are. And sooner or later, the world comes around. It's just the way the world works. Sooner or later, it comes around and it goes, you're actually pretty cool. You shouldn't be looking for it in the first place, but the world will understand it. And then the third is people who are patient because it takes time. Just be patient. Like there's don't rush it. Because if you do, I have an old uncle, Bamnan Sizwe. He must be in his late 50s now. I think maybe standard 2, standard 3 education. I say standard, giving away my age here. But standard 2, standard 3 education. And he always says to me, have you ever seen a big man fall over a tiny little pebble? He says, you know, typically what is he doing when a big man falls over a tiny pebble? He's running way too fast. He says, anytime you run too fast, even the smallest things will trip you up. Just slow down. Take it easy. Understand the terrain you're in and just spend time in the moment. Because we're just in pursuit, right? I mean, I look at us now with the fund. We want this and we want that. We want to raise that.
Hungry,
I want to get
driven,
into that place and I want to be there and I want to be. This is the market. Yeah. Bedar, Munir. Bedar.
You get there.
It's going to get there. And you want to get there in and at the right time and no sooner. Because if you get there sooner, you're likely going to be committing your mistakes.
Do you think your father would have been very proud to see what you've done?
You got to stop with the tough questions, man. I don't know. I would hope so. I would hope he would look at me and I'd hope that he would look at me and think that I've lived up to a smidge of my potential. I would hope.
Yeah, I would say, again, objectively, I can't say that he would be unimpressed. I can't say any father would be unimpressed. Tell me about the book in terms of what kinds of things people can learn from it. I mean, this is a useful book. This is not a book about just your journey. It's not a book just about theory and the economy at large. This is about practical, useful ways to make your business exponential.
Yeah.
And it's for everybody?
In the main, but it is for people who run, when you are running a sort of a high growth business, right? Or you're running a business that is medium sized and you're looking for growth, then that's kind of the business you want to be. It's the book. If you're in management or leadership, and you can only be in management or leadership if you are in two types of enterprises. One of that is either high growth or one that is medium-sized and looking for growth. And it could be a business, a political party, anything. Mm. But in the book, in essence, what it is I do is I dispel I help first people understand why the rate at which the world is moving, the rate at which things are changing, and the things that are driving the changes we're facing, and are experiencing are by their very nature driven by connected systems and driven and as a result become exponential. And so if we use linear thinking in exponential spaces, there's always going to be a gap there, that differential. The best way I can explain it, I was explaining it to a politician over December. I said to him, when was the last time you saw a service delivery protest that was half attended? He said, what do you mean? I said, you turn on the TV, there's a service delivery protest. The service delivery protests were concerts filling up stadiums. They'd be full all the time. Do you agree? He said, yes. I said, the reason that is because you guys have used a system of governance, government, management, and leadership that is built in a linear model where the problems you're facing are exponential. Go to DeepSlurt and watch the size that DeepSlurt has become versus what it was 10 years ago, mm-hmm. right? Go to Cosmos City, which didn't exist 10 years ago. Now it's an entire city. And what you realize is that there is an exponentiality about migration, about jobs, about what people are looking at, infrastructure, sure. The demands that people are placing on systems of governance and governments are exponential. But governance and governments continue to think in linear ways. So they continue to think it's got to be done the way it was done because that's how we've done it. The other way to think about it, and a guy who's kind of caught on to the curb a bit was Bayazid Issoufi.
Yes.
You know, because he was the first to go, well, we're going to do it this way and that way and that way. We're going to have an online system. He started thinking about nodes of exponentiality to help him fix what was an exponential problem. Otherwise, he was never going to get. And even then, he still can't get the number of learners into the system that he needs to get into the system. You're watching it happen now with higher education too. The demands being placed in higher education by their very nature are exponential. You look at the population growth, you look at the number of black people who are coming into the middle classes, the number of black people who are not yet in the middle classes who have got 2, 3, 4 kids that want to get into the middle class and see education as an access into that. And then you understand that we've not really built strong capacity to deliver exponential growth in how we deliver education. So we're using linear thinking in an exponential space, you're going to have a problem. So in effect, in the book, what it is I do is I talk about why the problems are exponential, why the thinking is linear, and what the impact of this disconnect is. But perhaps most important, what leaders and managers need to be doing so that they can correct it.
Fill that gap.
Fill the gap, yeah. So I spend a lot of time in the book talking about
technology. Technology will help, I assume.
Yeah, technology is an accelerator.
It's
a means to an end. It's never an answer, but it accelerates how you deliver it. There are other things that are more important. The culture, for instance, of how you work and why you work is very important. So why, for instance, is local government, specifically in South Africa, if I may, for a minute, why is local government locked in a quagmire of linearity? What is the culture? Just go to any local government office, see what time they open, what time they close, the fact that everybody takes lunch at exactly the same time. So we're using pre-industrial revolution working hours in an age today where people are saying, I want services and electricity at 7 o'clock at night. If it disconnects, I want it back on at 7:30. But you're saying, we'll be back tomorrow morning at 9:30. Call our call center, right? These are crude, perhaps, but these are perhaps the most glaring examples of where there is a disconnect in those two things.
Are you optimistic about solving these problems?
I think if there is a single thing that separates humanity from all other species, it is our ability to solve problems. Even if it means sometimes we've got to shed load. And we've done it a number of times. We shed load, right? We go through conflict. We go through world wars. We go through a whole host of things. But over time, humanity has proven its ability to grasp the full set of issues it faces and to solve them.
And to adapt to survive.
And to adapt. And in fact, if there is one thing that makes human beings, you know, the kings of the jungle, as it were, if you think about the sure. world as the jungle, is our ability to adapt. We're not the strongest. We're not the fittest. We're not, you know, we don't live the longest. But we do have an ability, an uncanny ability, to morph and to adapt to situations and circumstances as they shift and change.
Vusi, I wish you luck with the book. I'm sure it's going to be a tremendous success. The Magna Carta of Exponentiality. And it's his debut business Bible. It's very, very good to see you. I hope we will bump into each other more often.
Indeed, indeed.
And keep doing the good work you're doing. I think through the various fora that you use to explain and to tell your story and to explain your philosophy about how things work and how money flows downhill and all that kind of thing, you're probably emancipating more young black people than so many who promise them through rhetoric and false promises that they will do something for them, that they'll be a savior, or that it's not their fault. I think you're probably doing more hands-on, hard work, heavy lifting.
Wow.
And the fruits of that, I'm sure, will be borne out by many children and young adults and even people your own age who have taken a leaf out of your book. Very literally, in this case, a leaf out of your book. Thank you so much, Busy.
I'm humbled. It's always a pleasure and a privilege to be here. Every time I come here, I'm just blown away by what you've done here. It's never lost on me.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
It's never lost on me. But
great to see you, man.
Thank you very much.
Keep well, Gareth. Thank you, my friend.
This is CliffCentral.com.